On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Man walks into a restaurant and asks, "How do you prepare your chickens?" And the cook says, "Nothing special, really. We just tell them they're going to die." Bada boom, the human condition in a two-line joke about chickens. My guests today see philosophy all over the world of humor, a world where Woody Allen and Wittgenstein, Seinfeld and Socrates could have a great time cracking wise. Joining me in the studio today are the old friends and co-authors behind Plato and A Platypus Walk Into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes, Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein. Their little book debuted at number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list 2 weeks ago. Wow, I don't think you saw that coming. Tom Cathcart, Danny Klein, thanks very much for being here, Tom.
Hi, Tom. We sure didn't see it coming. No way.
And now it's on you like a cheap suit or a good suit, Danny Klein.
Well, I favor cheap suits, and since I'm used to them, I'm not going to change my ways now.
Okay. You guys don't claim to be professional philosophers. You took a philosophy class or two years and years ago at Harvard.
Well, we majored in philosophy.
Oh, well,
in college.
See. So it's a major.
But we don't have any graduate degrees, and it was 50 years ago.
Sergeant Pepper told the band to play. No, it was 50 years ago, but philosophy changes slowly. Lucky for you, it doesn't...
Absolutely.
Yeah. So humor, but jokes. Danny, why jokes to tell us about philosophy?
Well, we sort of discovered fairly early on that a lot of jokes do explain philosophical concepts. And Tom and I have been friends for 50 years.
Yeah.
And we've been doing two things together in those 50 years, telling jokes and talking philosophy.
That's a good friendship.
It is. It works for us. It doesn't work for our wives, but it works for us.
Right.
And so I told a joke one time,
yeah.
and Tom said, "God, do you realize that the philosophical content of that is amazing?" And should I tell the joke?
Well, let's hear it.
A man is making love to his best friend's wife, and they hear a car pull up in the driveway. So the guy jumps out of bed, stark naked, goes into the closet, closes the door. Well, the husband saunters in, goes to hang up his coat in the closet, and he sees his best friend Lou there. He says, stark naked,
yeah.
And he says, "Lou, what are you doing here?" And Lou says, "Everybody's got to be somewhere."
hello, Plato on the line. Professor Tom, okay, give
Professor
us the philosophical lesson.
Well, what I saw in the joke right away was that it was sort of a tension between Hegelian absolutism, Tom, and existential philosophy.
That was my first thought.
Yeah, I thought it
it seems so obvious.
Yeah, Hegel was a philosopher who sort of looked down on the universe from God's point of view and
yes.
sort of pontificated about the meaning of it all. And the existentialist came along and said, no, we can't do that. We can only see the world from this very human, limited, finite perspective
right.
with our anxieties and our troubles and what have you. And so obviously the guy, the husband, was asking for an existentialist answer. What are you doing here in
yes.
this particular situation? And the guy, for reasons of his own, chooses to answer it from Hegel's point of view. Everybody's got to be somewhere.
And philosophers can be as slick as anybody else, and there he is naked in the closet with an answer for everything. And off that, you build us a great big course, in a way, in kind of the fundamentals of philosophy. I mean, you march right down here in your chapters, metaphysics, logic, epistemology, no less. We get into all kinds of groovy stuff, teleology. Danny, you've got a good one for...
Yeah,
Telos.
It's a woman comes up to another woman who's wheeling her two grandchildren, and she says, "How old are your grandchildren?" And she says, "Well, the lawyer is 5 and the doctor is 7.
Okay, their grandchildren, they're 5 and 7, and she already sees in them their telos. She's giving in the teleology, Dr. Tom?
Exactly right, yeah. Aristotle said that everything has a telos. Everything has something that it's meant to be. Like the telos of an acorn is an oak tree. So she's already seeing the teleology of these two kids. One of them's going to be a doctor, the other's going to be a lawyer.
The grandma looks at grandchildren, and she sees it loud and clear, whether or not that's what they end up going. We've got listeners who are already piling in with their jokes that where philosophy hits the road. Let's go to Jim in Elyria, is it? Ohio, Jim? Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Elyria,
good to have you.
Elyria, yes.
We're delirious for Elyria. Give us a joke, Jim.
What did the Buddha say to the hot dog cart guy?
I don't know.
We know, but we're going to let you give the punchline.
Make me one with everything.
Right. Make me one with the universe.
Do you know the follow-up to that joke?
No, I don't.
The guy asks the vendor for change, and the vendor says change comes from within.
Perfect.
Jim, I love it. Thanks very much for calling in with that.
Thanks for having me.
Keep us educated. Take us down through your list. Metaphysics, give us a joke to explain what it's all about. All about.
Okay. Well, there's an old Jewish joke, a riddle.
Good.
Looks at the difference between Aristotelian essentialism and Aristotelian idea of accidental characteristics. And so shall we do it together, Tom?
All right, let's go.
Okay. I've got a riddle for you, Tom. What's green, hangs on the wall, and whistles?
Green, hangs on the wall, and whistles? You got me.
A herring.
A herring? A herring isn't green.
Put some paint on it, it's green.
But a herring doesn't hang on the wall.
Put a nail through it, it hangs on the wall.
But a herring doesn't whistle.
So it doesn't whistle.
Okay, philosophers at play.
Yes, and Tom can
now. Now, what have we
explain.
Just learned here, Tom?
Well, we learned the difference between essential characteristics. You know, Aristotle said that everything has essential characteristics, the things that make it what it is, and accidental characteristics, which have to do with how it is, but don't really determine what it is.
Is there a nail through the lip of the herring painted green on the wall?
Exactly right. Yeah.
Oh.
So he used the example of Socrates. He said, you know, Socrates' rationality is essential to his being Socrates. If he wasn't rational, he wouldn't be Socrates. On the other hand, Socrates' snub-nosedness...
Which he famously
right.
had a kind of a sawed-off nose
exactly
there.
Exactly right. And that was accidental. He said, you know, give him a nose job, he's Socrates with plastic surgery. He's still Socrates.
And there we are, ho, 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 in the middle of metaphysics. You go to logic and Sherlock Holmes and tell us, hey, he wasn't so logical, Dr. Watson.
Right, exactly. Want me to tell that one?
Sure.
Okay, well, this illustrates inductive logic. Everybody thinks that Sherlock Holmes was good at deducing things.
Yes,
but
he wasn't so deducing so powerfully. That's your point. That's right.
Right. He wasn't so much of a deducer. He was an inducer.
Let's hear it.
You know, he took his prior experience and he generalized from it. So Socrates, Sherlock is what I'm trying to say.
Yes.
Sherlock and Watson are on a camping trip. And Holmes wakes up in the middle of the night and he says, Watson, look up at the sky and tell me what you observe. And so Watson says, well, horologically, I'd say it's about a quarter of three. He says, meteorologically, he said, I'd say that it's going to be a sunny day tomorrow. He says, theologically, I'd say that God is all-powerful and I am very puny and weak. What does it mean to you, Holmes? Holmes says, Watson, you idiot, someone's stolen our tent.
It's inductive logic.
Yeah.
Because
he's concluding from his prior experience that that's probably what must have happened. You know, he sees the sky, he remembers he was there in a tent. He says, you know, when such things happen, it's probably because somebody's stolen our tent.
Now, if you look back on the ranks of the great philosophers then, some were all about induction, some about deduction. Who do you put where? Lines up with Watson and who with Holmes?
Well, actually, a number of rationalists, so-called rationalists, sort of end up with Watson. But the Holmes camp would be more of the empirical philosophers, the philosophers who talk about the philosophy of science, about observation and generalization, making theories out of particular observations. So I would say like the British empiricists, Hume, Berkeley, Locke, and then the philosophers of science in the 20th century.
All right. I've got a good joke for
please,
one of
please,
them.
Please, please, please.
Well, there was Karl Popper, who had a big influence on science, when he saw that in order for a theory to hold water, there has to be some possible, imaginable circumstances that could demonstrate it to be false.
Okay, fair enough.
And, it's amazing how many social scientists...
It took a long time to come to that.
Failed. So two guys... Here's a gag.
Okay.
Two guys are making breakfast. As one is buttering the toast, he said, did you ever notice that if you drop a piece of toast, it always lands butter side down?
Of course.
And the second guy said, no, it just seems that way because you remember the unpleasantness of cleaning up the floor. It's awful, yeah. And he says, look, drop a piece of toast, and you'll see it happens just as often. So he drops a piece of toast, and it drops butter side up. And so the skeptic says, yes, you see that? You see that? You're wrong. And the first guy says, no, I see what happened. I buttered the wrong side.
And with that, you look back to Sigmund Freud and say, oh, boy, we had a lot of people locked up in Freudism just kind of around that kind of argument for a century.
Well, a lot. Yeah, there's no way to prove Freud wrong.
Because?
Yeah. Because he'll, no matter what experience you'll tell him, he says, that's because of your mother.
Or if
there's
not,
no way to prove it wrong.
Father.
Yeah, right. He dreams about his father. He's in love with his mother. You know?
You can't escape it, and we can't escape humor. We learn when it comes to philosophy. Michael's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes. Good morning.
Hi. Good to have you.
I taught a course as a graduate student, an introductory course at a major public university. And when we came to ethics, I asked students to begin by writing a paper just summing up their moral code, just to get them to reflect on what they had already been living by.
Okay.
And one student wrote a paper which I otherwise absolutely forget anything he said, except that he spelled the word code wrong throughout the entire paper. And he wrote me an essay on living by a moral co-ed.
Co-ed. Well, that's a good place to start in life.
Yeah, that could have led to some very interesting...
exactly. Well, better than an immoral co-ed.
I don't know.
Glad, because the next paper was on epistemology.
Uh-oh, he's in deep trouble there. I don't know what he's going to spell there, but we're living by a moral co-ed or an immoral co-ed, depending where we start, Tom.
You know, back in the 1950s, there was a school of ethical philosophy that was very popular called emotivism. And emotivism, the major premise was that when you say something is good, you're not saying something about the thing. You're saying something about your own reaction. You're saying what it does to you emotionally. You approve of it, or it makes you feel good about it, or whatever.
American politics. Emotivism.
You got it.
Emotivism. Right. So the story is that a guy writes a letter to the IRS. And he says, I feel terrible. I feel so guilty. I'm losing sleep at night. I can't sleep. He said, I understated my income last year on my 1040.
Yeah.
So I said, I'm enclosing a check. And if I still can't sleep, I'll send you the rest.
Incrementalism and emotivism. Well, boy, thanks for the moral co-ed as a code to live by. Let's go to Buffalo, New York, and Phil. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What do you know?
Well, I got a story. I'm pretty sure it's a true story attributed to Sidney Morganbesser from Columbia University.
A funny man.
At a meeting, somebody asked the question, if it's true that two negatives make a positive, can two positives ever make a negative? And the story goes that Morganbesser speaks up and says, yeah, yeah.
I love it. Yeah, yeah. And there we are.
Morganbesser was one of the first great people in America to see the parallels between humor and jokes. He taught at Columbia University.
And there he had it in a nutshell with, yeah, yeah, we're going to get more from you, but we've got so many coming in. Let me get one from Milford, Connecticut. Brad, you're on the air with Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein, the philosophers with their platypus. What do you say?
Well, this is my favorite joke. It was actually a picture cartoon, but it works well just as a spoken joke. It's two fleas walking through a forest of giant hares, H-A-I-R.
Okay.
And one saying to the other, sometimes I find myself wondering if there really is a dog.
Okay. Now, Tom, deconstruct for you.
That's also an old dyslexia joke. The guy who stays up all night wondering if there's a dog.
agnostic dyslexic who does that.
Exactly.
There we go. Brad, thanks very much for that. Epistemology was on the syllabus of our first caller in this segment, and you deal with epistemology in humor. Danny Klein, what have you got for us? Epistemology, how do you know that you know the stuff you think you know?
Yeah, well, here, it's the same setup. I don't know why this setup keeps happening. But there's a guy who's in bed with his best friend's wife. It's the same guy.
Yeah, it's a classic. Same guy. Maybe the neighbor.
Okay, so another guy comes, the husband comes in and catches them. And before he can say anything, the guy in bed says, just a minute, before you say anything, Lou, what are you going to believe, me or your eyes?
How do you know what you think you know? You know.
Yeah.
You know.
Are you good? Where do you get your knowledge from? Empirically, or from authority?
Tom Cathcart, this has got a huge history in the philosophical realm.
Oh, it does indeed. There are some great empiricism jokes. You know, empiricism is the philosophy that says we get our knowledge of the external world through our senses,
mm-hmm.
but we also have to interpret that sensory experience. And so a guy goes to the doctor and he says, you know, doctor, he says, my wife, I think she's losing her hearing. And the doctor says, well, there's a very simple test for that. He said, when you go home, he said, why don't you stand behind her about 10 feet and ask her a question? And if she doesn't hear you, move up to about 5 feet and ask her again. And if she still doesn't respond, move up right behind her and ask her a third time.
Yeah.
So the guy says, okay, he goes home. He stands in the doorway of the kitchen. His wife has his back to him at the stove. He says, honey, what are we having for dinner? No response. So he moves halfway into the kitchen and he says, honey, what are we having for dinner? Still no response. So he moves up right behind her and he says, honey, what are we having for dinner? And she says, for the third time, chicken.
now, wait a minute. Help us here. Help us. So this tells us then.
This tells us that he needs to interpret the silence correctly, not just observe it.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. So there's more. There's more than meets the eye. David Hume might have enjoyed that one. The old empiricist Hume. Let's get another from Salem, Massachusetts. Seth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Rene Descartes walks into a bar. The bartender asks him if he would like a cup of coffee, and Rene Descartes says, I think not. Then he disappears.
I think, therefore I am. I think not. I'm gone. I love it, Danny.
Yeah, you know, before you were alluding to the fact that some political talk seems to disobey some of the rules of logic. And that gag I just told about, what are you going to believe, me or your eyes? I find myself screaming that at the president occasionally.
Well, every now and then.
Yes, I mean, they'll show us awful things happening in Iraq, and he'll say, it's going well. And I think, what am I going to believe, you or my eyes?
Right, but we keep thinking, cogito ergo sum. Right? We've got
exactly.
Descartes, I think, at 4 a.m., and we've disappeared in a coffee bar.
Yeah.
If we're not thinking.
Well, another good Descartes story is there's... my mind has gone blank. Descartes story. I know what I was going to tell you. Descartes went through a what he called radical doubt. He was trying
yes.
to see if there was anything certain. And so he thought, well, I can doubt away the external world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe I'm dreaming, maybe I'm hallucinating. But, you know, I can't doubt the fact that there's a doubter. You know, I'm doubting, so I must exist.
So a doubter
That's how exists. He got to, I think, therefore I am. He should have said, I doubt, therefore I am, but I think, therefore I am. So there's a story about radical doubt that has to do with a jury trial. And because the standard in a jury trial isn't radical doubt, but it's reasonable
Beyond
doubt.
Beyond reasonable doubt.
All right. So the defense attorney is defending a murder victim, but so far the prosecution has not been able to produce a body.
Mm.
There's a lot of circumstantial evidence, but no body. And so the defense attorney in his summation says, you know, he said, all through this trial, we've been pushing the prosecution to produce a body. There isn't one. And so what I'm about to tell you is that in 1 minute, the alleged corpse is actually going to walk through the door.
Okay, big setup.
Big setup. And so the minute goes by, nothing happens. And so finally the attorney turns to the jury and he says, obviously the corpse did not walk through the door. But he said, I want to point out to you that when I said that, every one of you turned and looked at the door. So obviously there's a reasonable doubt in this case whether the alleged victim is actually dead.
Oh.
So the jury ponders that, and they recess, and they come to their conclusion. They come back into the courtroom, and the foreman says, we find the defendant guilty. And the defense attorney jumps up, and he says, I object. He said, every one of you looked at the door.
Mm.
And he said, the foreman of the jury says, well, yes, we all did, but the defendant didn't.
Right. So we learn, and we learn, and we learn. I want to ask you about what you see in comedians, because they, of course, are using jokes all the time, and maybe actively or not actively working on philosophy. I've got a little clip here from somebody that we think of as kind of dealing all the time with philosophy. 1986 film, Hannah and Her Sisters. Mickey Sachs, played by Woody Allen, goes to a movie theater after a botched suicide attempt. Here he is.
How can you even think of killing yourself? I mean, isn't it so stupid? I mean, look at all the people up there on the screen. You know, they're real funny. And what if the worst is true? What if there's no God and you only go around once and that's it? Well, you know, don't you want to be part of the experience?
Don't you want to be part of it? At least, Danny Klein, do you hear comedians wrestling with your philosophers in their everyday work?
Particularly Woody Allen. I mean, he hits philosophical notes all the time. One of my favorites of his is when he said, I've just learned that actually nothing exists. And he says, and one of the things I realized is I overpaid for my carpeting.
And I'm walking on it right now. I love it. But do you have to be a philosopher to be a good comedian? I mean, is that the meat that comedians are feasting on?
I think the best ones are.
Contradictions, the great questions, our expectations dashed by empiricism.
Yes. And taking the odd look at things. We've noticed, Tom Cathcart and I have noticed, that often the experience of getting a philosophical idea and getting a really tricky joke are about the same, a little bit like James's aha experience. You finally get it, and it's a kind of quick and joyful enlightenment.
Give us another one. Give us a little lightning ride to some enlightenment then, Danny. What have you got
in your big book? Okay, this is one of my favorites, and it has to do with what they call an informal fallacy, not a strict logical fallacy, but an informal fallacy, which is called in Latin post hoc ergo propter hoc.
Oh, which means, which a great pickup line, you say, unless you translate it.
It works.
It
makes me into a chick magnet. Yeah. You know? What it means is because something comes before something else, that means it is the cause of the second thing. Which of
the
course,
informal fallacy.
Yes, of course, it ain't necessarily so. Mm-hmm. But one of my favorite post hoc ergo propter hoc jokes is about an older guy marries a younger woman.
Yeah.
And no matter how much effort he puts into his lovemaking, she just isn't responding.
Okay.
So he goes to his rabbi, and his rabbi says, we have that problem sometimes. Yeah. He says, we have a solution to it. He says, what you do is you get somebody else to wave a towel over you while you're making love. That'll usually do it. He says, a younger man, he says, actually helps quite a bit. So he hires a younger man to wave the towel. He's in bed making love to his young wife. Nothing. She doesn't feel a thing. So he goes back to the rabbi, and the rabbi says, well, sometimes we have to make a minor adjustment, and what we do is we put the younger man in bed with your wife and you wave the towel.
The all-important towel.
The all-important towel. You got it. And so the younger man gets in bed. She's screaming with ecstasy. And the older man who's waving the towel over them says, idiot, that's the way you wave a towel.
Take that, my young friend.
Yes.
And the informal fallacy is right there for all to see. Daniel Klein and Thomas Cathcart are with us, authors, co-authors of the new New York Times bestseller, Plato and a Platypus, Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's take a call from Arlington, Massachusetts. Gary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a Zen baseball story.
Ooh, good.
It's three umpires getting ready to go call a baseball game. And the first umpire says, well, I call them as I see them. And the second umpire says, he's a little pompous, I call them as they are. And the third umpire says, they ain't nothing until I call them.
Oh, almost a Zen cone.
That's almost Kantian, isn't it, Tom?
What do we got? What do we have here?
Boy, I don't know. I don't see Kant in there. Help me with this.
Well, it's until the third guy, the guy who says they ain't nothing until I call them, until I put them in some kind of category.
A little
they
critique
don't
of
exist.
Pure reason,
there
and then
we
maybe.
Go. Okay.
Is there something there?
Oh, definitely something there. Yeah.
Gary, what do you put there? Take us in on your Zen plane.
Well, there is no reality other than the one we create.
Perfect.
And if we bring in Kant, the world can only be known insofar as it conforms to the mind's own structure. And we're in the realm of philosophy.
You are good.
Is that right over home plate?
Oh, gosh. You're so good.
Can't beat it.
I love it. Give us another, Danny. What have you got?
Well, this one is another informal fallacy called the circular argument, which we're familiar with. So it's autumn, and the Indians on the reservation are ask their new chief if it's going to be a cold winter. Well, this guy is raised in the modern world. He doesn't really know the old secrets,
yeah.
And so he doesn't know whether it's going to be cold or not. So be on the safe side. He advises the tribe to collect wood and get prepared. A few days later, you know, just to check, he calls the National Weather Service and asks if they're forecasting a cold winter. And the meteorologist says, well, he thinks it's going to be quite cold. So the chief advised the tribe to stock up on even more wood. A couple weeks later, the chief checks in with the weather service. He says, does it still look like a cold winter? And he says, the meteorologist says, sure does. Looks like it's going to be a very cold winter. The chief tells the tribe to gather up every scrap of wood they can find. A couple weeks more pass. The chief calls the weather service again and asked how the winter was looking at this point. The meteorologist says, we are now forecasting that it'll be one of the coldest winters on record. Yeah. Really? Said the chief. How can you be so sure? And the meteorologist replies, well, heck, the Indians are collecting wood like crazy.
Never mind the satellite. Never mind the weather balloon. And the circle is complete.
The circle is complete. They're each getting evidence from each other.
Unbroken. Do you have any idea if philosophers themselves, I mean, I don't care who you're talking about, you know, whether it's Rousseau or Sartre or Socrates, are they known for having a sense of humor? Do philosophers themselves joke?
Well, the classical philosophers, I have no idea, but some of the best teachers of philosophy are very witty. Like we just heard the Morgan Besser quote, and some of the... some of the people that we had in school were very entertaining because it is a similar kind of mindset, I think.
You set out writing this thinking professors would be the ones who would buy it.
Yeah, we thought it was just a little niche market.
Why do you think it's caught on so big?
I don't know. I think philosophy's in the air right now.
Well,
I
mean, we need that, it. That we book need to on, explain
on
things.
Bowl, blah, 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 by the Princeton professor.
Mm-hmm. Who we spoke with, yeah.
Oh, you did?
Yes. But
And now all these books from the so-called new atheists.
Let's listen to a little bit more from, here's from film, 1982, Tootsie. Unemployed actor Michael Dorsey is played by Dustin Hoffman, and his agent George Fields is played by Sidney Pollack. They're arguing about Hoffman's portrayal, Michael Dorsey's, of a tomato.
You play the tomato for 30 seconds, they want a half a day over schedule because you wouldn't sit down.
Yes, it wasn't logical.
You were a tomato! A tomato doesn't have logic. A tomato can't move.
That's what I said. So if he can't move, how's he going to sit down, George?
No, a tomato doesn't sit down, and we're into the essence of things, Tom.
Absolutely. If you don't obey the classical rules of logic, you can get into some wild places. Like the guy who walks into the Dublin bar, and he says to the bartender, give me 3 pints of Guinness.
Yeah.
And the bartender says, okay, he pours him 3 pints. The guy takes him down to the end of the bar, drinks them one after the other, comes back to the bartender and asks for 3 more. The bartender says, well, fine, but you know they'd be less likely to go flat if I gave them to you one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And the man says, well, no, I know that. But he said, I have 2 brothers, one in the United States and one in Australia. And he said, we used to drink together. And when we parted, we decided we would have this custom of always drinking three pints at a time.
Very touching.
Yeah, very touching. And that's what the bartender said. He said, oh, that's a very wonderful custom. So the guy becomes a regular in the bar. And one day, a couple months later, he walks in and he orders 2 pints of Guinness.
Mm.
And a silence falls over the bar. And the bartender says, oh, I'm terribly sorry. Please accept my condolences. And the guy says, no, everybody's fine. He says, I just became a Mormon and I had to give up drinking.
But he's still drinking the brother's beers. We love it. Dave is calling from Spokane, Washington. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Hi.
I wanted to know if your two guests could comment on the influence of comedians on maybe raising the level of a philosophy kind of to the common man, like Stephen Wright, Gary Larson, Monty Python's Flying Circus, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah. How about it, Danny Klein, among humorists, speaking broadly there with Larson, Gary Larson, the cartoonist, of course, who do you see sort of lifting the philosophical bar in humor?
I think so. I think you'll find philosophy in surprising places, not just in old dusty tomes, you know, and in Doonesbury. You'll find philosophical ideas, you know, that kind of pulling the rug out from your way you see reality in a comic way, which has a lot in common with philosophy. It just doesn't you know, have all the fancy categories and words of some philosophy.
Stephen Wright, I have to say, I don't know. Maybe I do and just don't know the name. But, Tom, who do you think sort of lifts it up high when it comes to their humor? I mean, Carlin likes to get cosmic, but is that the same as being philosophical?
Actually, I think it is. Yeah, Carlin was the first person that came to mind for me, George Carlin. He always has sort of a transcendent take on things. And I think that's one of, by the way, one of the commonalities between philosophy and humor is that they both sort of take us to a different place where we're sort of looking down on our ordinary experience. It's a sort of transcendent thing. And Carlin does that very well.
Mm. Let's get a call from West Haven, Connecticut. Nina, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I have two quick questions for the philosophers. Why do we need jokes? And since the mind seems to crave a narrative structure that makes sense, why does the twist or the surprise of a joke delight us?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, deep. Why do we need jokes? And then the twist, both in philosophy and in humor, you all write and say that matters. What do you say to Nina?
Well, it's kind of a psychological question. Why do we need them? And we don't know much about psychology. But
don't we have a thirst for understanding? And if the joke is the thing that takes us to the inside, I mean, aren't the jokes themselves often built around that hunger to sort of break through and get it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so. I think it's like what Tom just said, that to get that kind of boost of transcendence so that you get out of yourself and your normal categories of interpreting reality and get yourself a new category that has some surprises. And with surprise comes delight. Maybe does that answer your question?
Nina may be gone, but the twist is there. In the joke, of course. I mean, it's what makes us laugh, hoot, cry. Do philosophers play with the twist as well? Is that what it takes to sort of break through and get on the big list of philosophers in the sky?
Yeah, to get on the big list, I think that is what it takes. And as far as humor is concerned, it's interesting because even what we call low humor, you know, somebody slipping on a banana peel, in a way, that has a philosophical twist to it, too, because the reason it makes us laugh, and I think this may go to the heart of Nina's question, is that all of a sudden, when somebody slips on a banana peel, we see through sort of the social conventions and the politeness and the trying to be cool and all of the social stuff that we carry around with us, and we see life as it really is, you know? We really are fallible people who fall on our prat occasionally.
On our prat, to put it gently. Let's get a call and maybe a joke from Jim in Londonderry, New Hampshire. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. How y'all doing today?
We're all right.
All right. Hey, I just maybe you guys could shed some light on why this joke makes me crack up every time I hear it. Let's see. Here we go. What do you get when you cross a Zen Buddhist with a Jehovah's Witness?
Jim, I don't know. What do you get when you cross a Zen Buddhist with a Jehovah's Witness?
The sound of one hand knocking.
Oh, I like it.
Very nice.
I like it. Yeah.
There's a whole series of those. There's one about what happens if you cross a Unitarian with a Jehovah's Witness.
And?
The answer is somebody who knocks on your door in the middle of the day and then has nothing to tell you.
Oh, that's mean. That's mean. Let's see. Yes. Okay, give us more, Danny. Keep us going.
You know, one of the responses to Nina's question is often humor in a psychological and philosophical sense tackles stuff that causes us great anxiety. And the big one, of course, is death, which figured very much an existential thought. You know, people like Heidegger say you can't lead the authentic life, you know, a really conscious life, unless you face the fact that you're mortal. And so there are all kinds of jokes that do that. What's your favorite on that one?
I like the one about the painter who goes into the gallery where his stuff is being shown, and he asks the gallery owner, "How's my stuff doing?" And the owner says, "Well, I have some good news and some bad news." He said, "The good news is this morning a man walked into the shop and asked me if I thought you were the kind of painter whose work would be more valuable after your death." And I told him I thought you were, and he bought everything in the place. And the painter says, "Well, that's fabulous. What's the bad news?" The gallery owner says, "He was your doctor."
Oh, no. And down we go. Down we go. Danny, give us more on the existentialist thread.
Well, can I keep on with the existentialist?
Or the death? And death? Sure. I mean, Aristotle said our telos was happiness, but that got twisted a little later with Heidegger. What? It's facing death and awareness.
Facing it.
Our inner destiny.
He was a real upper Heidegger. Yeah. I mean, he was a million laughs. Well, can I tell the world's saddest joke?
Okay, we've got our long face on.
Okay, you all set for it?
Yeah.
So this old Jewish couple, they're in their 80s, and they go to the rabbi, and they say, "We want to get divorced." The rabbi says, "My God, you've been married for 62 years, and you're in your 80s. What do you want to get divorced for now?" And the man says, "Well, we've wanted to for a long time, but first we wanted to wait until the children were dead."
Oh, God, that's terrible.
It's awful.
It's terrible.
Do we have room for one more death joke?
Absolutely, okay.
Three friends are killed in an automobile accident, and they're standing up in heaven talking about what they would like people to think about them and their lives. And one of them says, "Well, what do you hope that people are thinking at your wake as they stand there looking at you in the coffin?" And the first guy says, "Well, I'm hoping that they'll think he was a wonderful family man and father." And the second guy says, "Well, I'm hoping they'll think that I was a wonderful physician and that I was very caring to my patients." Yeah. And the third guy says, "I'm hoping they'll think, look, he's moving."
All right. We're back from the dead, or maybe, and we're climbing a ladder of philosophy to do it. Doug is calling from Randolph, Massachusetts. Doug, what have you got?
Hi, Tom. This is another Woody Allenism. I forget the film, but Woody was wrestling with the concept of the Christian concept of the afterlife.
Yes.
And he says, "You know, the way I understand it, if you're a good person and you don't sin very much and you believe, after you die, you spend an eternity with God. Second prize is two eternities."
So spare me that, please, says Woody. We got it. Doug, thanks very much for that one. Let's get another call from Little Compton, Rhode Island. Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, gentlemen. That's a wonderful topic today. I just have a quick comment. In this hectic, fast-paced world, a lot of times you're required to be places, you know, that are very difficult to get to quickly.
Oh, yeah.
And my reply would be from Monty Python's Flying Circus. How can you be in two places at once when you're really no place at all?
Heavy. Now, who are we hovering there with, Tom?
You got me.
No place at all? Oh, no. Let's see.
For some unusual reason, probably having nothing to do with anything except it's one of my favorite jokes.
Yeah.
This one is about the default position of empiricism in our daily life.
Okay.
That really, no matter how much of an idealist we think we are, really, we depend on our senses.
Mm.
So there are three women in the dressing room of their racket closet.
Good.
And a guy comes running through naked with a bag over his head. And don't ask.
Okay.
So the first woman looks at him and says, "Well, he's not my husband." And the second one woman says, "No, he isn't." And the third one says, "He's not even a member of the club."
And we've been right around the world there. Okay. Warren, Rhode Island. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. I've enjoyed the show.
Yeah, me too. What have you got?
A man walks into a coffee shop, and he asks the waitress, "Bring me a cup of coffee without cream." And she says to him, "I'm sorry, we're out of cream. I can let you have it without milk."
That's great. That's great. Yeah. That's linguistic philosophy, isn't it, Tom?
A little zenny there, too, I think.
We're learning. We're climbing the tree of consciousness. I love it, Tom. Thank you very much for that. I'll ponder that next time I'm sitting in front of my cup of coffee. How about one from Burlington, Vermont? Solvay, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm loving the death theme. Death and humor always go together, and I thought I'd share this one. So these two Jersey hunters come up to the woods in Vermont, and they're out there, and accidentally one of the guys shoots his friend. He's really panicked. He's like, oh my god. He calls 911. He's like, "I think I shot my friend. I think he's dead." And the lady says, "Okay, calm down. First thing you need to do is make sure if he's actually dead or not." And then there's a slight pause, and then she hears a gunshot. And he comes back and he's like, "Well, okay, he's dead."
Now what do I do?
It sounds like Tony Soprano on a hunting safari in Vermont. That's a little brutal.
Actually, there are some philosophers who maintain that ordinary languages like English are so vague that we really ought to replace them with more precise languages like mathematics. And that sort of illustrates the point. You know, maybe with a more precise language, we could have avoided this tragedy.
Yeah, I don't know. What's the take from those Jersey boys? That's great. Thanks, Solve. Thanks very much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're getting toward, we've just got a few minutes here. We better talk about a little more about God and religion and philosophy of religion. What have you got on that score?
Well, I'll tell you, one of my all-time favorite faith versus reason jokes.
Yes, please.
So there's this old guy, and he's walking in the woods, and he suddenly falls down a well. He drops hundreds of yards, and he reaches out, and he grabs onto the spindly root on the side of the well, and he's just hanging there for dear life, and he yells up, "Is there anybody up there?" All of a sudden, there's a thunderclap. A beam of light shines down into the well, and a big voice says, "I am the Lord your God. Have faith in me, and I will save you. Let go of the root." And the guy says, "Is there anybody else up there?"
Faith and reason.
Reason triumphs. Yes.
I would rather hang on. Thank you, sir.
There are no believers in the foxhole.
Keep us going. We just got a couple of minutes. Take us, I don't know, anywhere you like on the philosophical range where it really matters.
Well, okay. As long as we're speaking about religion, one of the confusing things is what are the differences between the various religious denominations?
Yeah.
And it turns out that the way you tell the difference between the denominations is according to what they recognize and what they don't recognize. For example, Jews don't recognize Jesus. Protestants don't recognize the Pope. And Baptists don't recognize each other in the liquor store.
Okay, Danny, maybe one more here. What do we got?
Okay, this is actually a very tricky thing about the confusion between analytic and a priori and synthetic statements.
Okay.
We won't even go there. I'll just tell the joke. And the joke is, there's a surefire way to live to a ripe old age. Eat a meatball a day for 100 years.
And a priori, you will be 100.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, boy.
It's the way it happens.
You guys are good. You must be having a good time with this thing.
We're having a lot of fun. We're having a lot of time. It's kind of the culmination of what we've been doing for the last 50 years anyhow.
Something tells me you're probably already collecting a new raft of jokes, or am I wrong?
We have to.
We collected a few this morning.
Yeah.
Thank you out there in Radio Land.
Yes, I particularly like that one about the umpire, didn't you?
We're all pitching in here. It's a beautiful thing. It's been just wonderful talking with you, and I'm so happy to see it kind of pay off in this way. This is what friends are for, right? Sit around for a lifetime of jokes and philosophy.
We've never made any money before.
Well, a little on the way out doesn't hurt.
Yes, yes.
Only in the sense that we're all on the way out.
Right.
We're more on the way out than you are.
I don't know. This is Daniel Klein and Thomas Cathcart. Hats off to you. Congratulations on how well the book is doing. Thanks for all your good insights and good humor. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
The book is Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Yeah. I'm hanging down south, just chilling in a room with Scotsmen with an attitude, Monica, David Hume. You a philosopher, my friend. He mutters under his breath, "I'm gonna shred your beliefs till there's nothing left." David Hume.